I'm getting the feeling that you guys come from like the fix the money, fix the world sort of side from Bitcoin. Yeah. And my experience is I really, having been in crypto from the beginning, you know, is that not really the direction that it's going? Yeah. I don't really think that having a Bitcoin standard would, you know, fix the world, because look at, we have all of the derivatives. Yeah. We have the ETF. We have every way to derive the value from the pristine collateral that Bitcoin is.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps. Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Today we are talking with Michael Parenti, aka the Exiled Surfer. Mike, how are you doing? And tell us a little bit where you got the name Exiled Surfer. Where are you exiled from?
I'm originally from Malibu, California. And in 1992, Jerry Garcia announced that he had cancer. And there was going to be the last Grateful Dead tour. Steve Miller Band was the headliner. And so I knew Mickey Raphael from Steve Miller Band. And I thought, okay, cool. You know, let's go see the Dead and do the tour, right? And I opened my mouth at the wrong time in the wrong place, which happened to be Indiana, and was mouthy with what turned out to be a couple of undercover cops who thought that I was like, you know, knew what they were doing. And so they grabbed me and handcuffed me and took me to a fast court. And I was one of 250 or more hippies that were arrested that day. They took 100 hits of acid off of somebody else that they had arrested, put him in front of the judge, and you know, said, "Hey, this guy's dealing drugs." And I was on tour selling T-shirts, you know, like you do, you know, tailgate parties and stuff to like finance my thing. And so I had like about 20 grand in my butt bag on me. So there I was with 20 grand in cash, and two dirty cops had said that I was selling acid. So the bail was 100 grand. I got it reduced to 5 grand, got out, paid $500, got out on bail, and, you know, went home to Malibu. And it was two felony counts, one for possession with intent to sell. So I was looking at that time at the height of America's war on drugs, I was looking at a minimum sentence of 26 years. I had a 6-month-old daughter and an Austrian wife. And I wasn't really a clean kid. And my parents got me out of trouble a couple of times, you know, being a freedom-loving, you know, punk rocker and hippie in California, you know, privileged kid. They got me out of trouble a couple of times. And this time they went, "Nah, we don't believe you." And I was like, you know, boy who cried wolf, really, I'm serious. And they went, "Nah." So instead of fighting it and getting a public defender, you know, I got on a plane and flew to Austria. And so that's the background of my story, which I didn't tell people for 23 years. I lived and traveled and had passports and stuff for 23 years. And then when I got married the second time, I had to renew my passport, and I went into the embassy, and they were like, "Nope, you have this old failure to appear
right.
from Indiana." So it took 23 years for it to percolate up. Indiana was the last state in the union to digitalize their court records. And so they confiscated my passport and said, "You can have one that's good for 1 week for one-way travel to America to answer these charges." And I was like, "Okay, you guys gonna arrest me?" And they're like, "No, we're not gonna do that. You just gotta sign this piece of paper recognizing your status." And so I walked out of there, and I ended up getting asylum in Austria. So I have legal residency here since 2015. And yeah, so that's like kind of why it is that I left.
Wow, that's a good reason.
Wow, that's quite a way to start the episode, I have to say.
You ought to, so you guys talk about surviving on Bitcoin. You really like hit the fucking nail on the head with my life, you know? So
at this point is the
no
statute of limitation?
No statute of limitations, because I was arrested and charged and didn't appear, right? So statute of limitations is only good if you commit a crime and they don't charge you for it, right?
So, sure.
And I have I have legal residency here because Austria and most of Europe does not extradite to a country where the punishment is higher than it is in the country of residence. And so here it would have been like a slap on the wrist and probation sort of thing.
Yeah.
For that sort of thing.
Right.
For the first
Interesting.
So, yeah. So anyway, so I ended up, you know, applying for my FBI file. And this is where the connection with Bitcoin is and surviving on Bitcoin or getting fucked by Bitcoin. So I want my FBI file. And, you know, it turns out that I was one of the people that was under investigation for working at the Bitcoin Foundation. You know, because when Gavin went to the, you know, the CIA and John Matonis was going to SWIFT and Charlie Shrem had gotten arrested and, you know, Silk Road had been happening and all that stuff was, they were investigating the Bitcoin Foundation. I was the system administrator for the Bitcoin Foundation and the Bitcoin Foundation was a 501c in Delaware and they were filing, you know, 1040s for us. So I was on the list and, you know, so that was why it is that they started looking into me and this thing came up and I had all of the, you know, it's amazing what the government knows about us all. We're all so fucked. It's just not even funny. So, you know, I got all of my chat logs. They had fucking everything on me from Occupy Wall Street, from WikiLeaks, from, you know, Anonymous, from all the different shit that I was, you know, involved in online and stuff. It was all in my FBI report. And so, yeah. If I hadn't worked for the foundation, I probably would have, you know, been okay. You know?
Have you been back since?
No, I've never been back. Yeah, no,
So you just picked up your things with your family in Malibu, California, and you just left.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents both
died in 99. And then, you know, so I couldn't, like, even go to their funerals and stuff. And sold the house to Chris Carter, the director of X-Files. He was our next-door neighbor. And, you know, yeah.
What was the family sort of situation during?
I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
No worries. Well, I was just asking, I'm wondering what the family situation was during that time. It's like you basically informed them that we have to get out of here and we're never coming back. Like, you had the six-month-old, you know, this sounds like a crazy time, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was bitter, man. It was bitter. We fought a lot and, you know, the marriage didn't survive. We're good friends now. We're all tight. No, I left because of my daughter, man. I just like daughter growing up without a father and, you know, that stuff. And I left my wife to have a future. She had didn't even have a high school diploma and they're both happy and safe here in Austria. My ex-wife is a lawyer now. She works for the FMA, which is the Finanzmarktaufsicht, which is the part of the government that audits banks. And my daughter's a tattoo artist. So, and they're both happy and secure. And we do Thanksgiving together and, you know, they're still family and whatever, but it was bitter in the beginning. But when I look at America now, you know, it was quite a blessing.
Yeah. Right. So obviously if you had a considerable Bitcoin savings, like especially, you know, in cold storage, this action you had to take of seeking refuge, leaving the country on short notice to avoid persecution and start a new life on another continent in another country. It would have been a lot easier, obviously, if you had a lot of Bitcoin to go with you. So, you know, what was that like on short notice? You didn't have time to plan. You had to get up and go to a foreign country. You said you had, you know, your wife was an Austrian citizen. So you had that at least. But what was that transition like without having any real, I mean, were you able to get access to some sort of, you know, money, savings, income, something?
Dude, man, I hit the ground running and I started working. I started working as a music journalist, right? So my history in the States was, you know, I don't know if you guys ever heard of the Surf Punks, but that was a band that I managed in the, you know, in the 80s. And, you know, I programmed dance nights, the Whiskey a Go-Go and at Wolf and Rissmuller's Country Club. I was a music guy, right? So I hit the ground running here and started working as a music journalist, writing in English. And then I started learning German and had my articles translated and stuff. And then I put on music conventions here, kind of like NAMM sort of stuff. And, you know, people got to know me. And, you know, when people came into town to be interviewed, they knew who they were, you know. It was really funny, like, you know, Montel Jordan, who I went to school at Pepperdine, right? And Montel was on the basketball team at Pepperdine, right?
Beautiful campus.
And when This Is How You Do It came out, you know, we, like, there was the five journalists that get to interview the hit guy, and he walks into the room and he sees me. He's like, yo, Michael, what's up? You know? And so, you know, that kind of like gave me a lot of cred. And when David Lee Roth showed up and all the other different people that I knew from LA, you know, I got cred here pretty quickly. So I started working for Austrian National Television, became a television producer and a music video director. No, I hit the ground running, man. I was like, you know, I'm a privileged white dude from Malibu, right? With all the stuff that comes along with it, you know, confidence and moxie, and, you know, and Americans are, you know, are welcome here. So I just use that to my advantage. So, you know, I just started making money, you know, and what, doing it.
Why was it the sort of media direction that you entered into? How did you get into that?
In Austria or at home?
Yeah. Well, I guess if it started in home, then how did that transition? Because you said you were meeting up with the Dead, or you were just following the Dead around, and then.
Yeah, it was just one of the things. Just one of the things I was doing. I wasn't a Deadhead. It was just like, you know, I just knew people, and the Dead was happening as pre-Burning Man, you know, right? It was an interesting thing to do. So I just, you know, it was just something that I was doing as a free person, you know, not that, but music. I mean, like, all the people that I grew up with, you know, were in movies. So I grew up across the street from Sean Penn, down the street from Emilio Estevez, right? And, you know, so I grew up in a background of show business, and all the kids that I grew up with were in movies. So I just didn't want to be like everybody else. And I was in music, and punk was happening. And, you know, I just, growing up in Malibu, you know, like I said.
Yeah.
You know,
what did your family do? Like, what did your parents do to live in Malibu?
My dad had a vending machine out in Los Angeles, and my mom was his bookkeeper.
That's incredible.
Did Malibu have that same kind of elite sort of status that it has? Well, not anymore, I guess, after the fires, did it have that same kind of feeling back then?
Well, you know, there was a lot more houses on Pacific Coast Highway than there are right now.
Yeah, for sure.
No, it wasn't really that elite. Of course, there was always, you know, it was the land of stars, of course, but it was casual, and, you know, there weren't a lot of fences, and it wasn't what it is now, for sure. No, I mean, you know, so I was born in 63. I grew up there, you know, in the 60s and 70s, right? And 80s, right? So it was totally different then than it is now, you know, but it still was.
What is your...
There's people there.
Yeah, what is your, as a, you know, looking from the outside, looking in and seeing what United States has become, but especially, you know, your home, like Los Angeles, Hollywood, Malibu, and just kind of seeing that evolution and seeing how fiat has, I think that's probably one of the places in the United States where fiat's, you know, consequences are seen
the headquarters.
Most. Yeah. How do you feel about that? You haven't been able to be back and see it yourself, but what do you like? What is it like seeing your home, you know, kind of change the way that it has?
Oh man, you know, that's a long question. I could probably spend an hour answering that.
Let's do it.
Let's see, where do we even start with something like that? I mean, you know, so California, you know, has Proposition 13, right? And so we have the low property taxes, right? And your property is only assessed once it's being sold, right? So if you bought it earlier, you know, your property taxes are low. You know, it allows for, you know, a lot of privilege to happen. That being said, you know, it's really fucking worth it to live in Malibu, right? You know, I mean, the sun, the sand, the surf, the lifestyle, everything, it is magic. And people dream of, you know, of it all over the world, right? So I can understand why it is that people go there. I think the tendency in society, you know, is while you see it in Malibu, I think the tendencies, you know, just they have really the roots in the Reagan era. Really, you have to go back all the way back to Reagan breaking the air controllers union, and Trump is the logical end to that, right? So, I mean, I'm not really surprised. It's kind of like logical that we have this narcissistic, you know, self-contained, you know, hyper turbo, you know, narcissist at the top of America right now, because that's the direction that we chose quite a long time ago. And Hollywood may be part of that. Malibu may be part of it, but it's not, you know, the thing that makes it tick, right? There's choices that we made, political choices, economic choices, educational choices, you know, that flow back from Reagan. It's been incredibly painful, right? So a lot of the things I was involved with, like Occupy Wall Street and WikiLeaks and stuff, you know, they come from that hippie ethos and that punk rock ethos that I grew up with in California, you know. But it's California was never really part of the States, right? You know, we used to joke that California is not America, you know. So I don't know that I would say that I feel bad about Malibu. Actually, watching it burn, I was quite emotionless, you know. I was just like, wow. I fought those fires multiple times. I mean, we have the joke in California, right? What are the four seasons? They're fires, mudslides, right? Earthquakes and high tides, right? It's just the way it was growing up, you know, being in Malibu. So it didn't really, you know, affect me, other than the fact that we keep rebuilding over and over and over again with the same, you know, with the same clusterfuck of building regulations and whatever, and the same clusterfuck of corruption that you find everywhere in the world where money centralizes and where people have a benefit that they can take advantage of because they have access to power. I mean, you know, we can do a whole show about the water situation in California, right? and how that's owned by and controlled by one billionaire couple to grow almonds and avocados and cranberries, you know. I mean, there's just it all intersects and you know, so I'm getting the feeling that you guys come from like the fix the money, fix the world sort of side from Bitcoin. Yeah. And my experience is I really, having been in crypto from the beginning, you know, is that not really the direction that it's going. Yeah, I don't really think that having a Bitcoin standard would you know fix the world, because we have all of the derivatives. Yeah, we have the ETF, we have every way to derive value from the pristine collateral that Bitcoin is, and it is in German an Erscheinung, right? It is a first and last time thing. I'm totally on that train, but I'm way off the side of, you know, fix the money, fix the world thing, because it really doesn't take into account the ingenuity of human beings who are willing to, you know, construct narratives that they can sell other people on. And we just do not have the level of education that it is that we need at the basic level to participate any kind of civics. Yeah. Let alone, you know, the depth of economics that Bitcoin represents. Right. So. Yeah,
that's interesting. So you're right. The fix the money, fix the world meme or ethos that you talk about is very, it seems from my perspective, very U.S. centric, U.S. podcast centric, you know, and it's the Bitcoin. Yeah. The Bitcoin community in the U.S. has really rallied. It used to be this very, you know, had this anarchist roots, very anti-state, and now it's really jumped in bed with politicians and the government. And like you said, in Wall Street, you got the ETFs, you have all these derivatives that are coming off of Bitcoin, and all of these institutions and these you know, merchants and these, you know, just organizations are leeching as much value that they can get off of it. And it's not really seeming like this money system is being used to correct or fix incentives in a lot of, like you said, like economic senses, societal senses, a civic sense. So I guess from your point of view, what is the kind of like the why or the purpose behind Bitcoin that really motivates you and makes you optimistic about what it can do for your life, or, you know, and then people's lives, without this utopian, if we're on the Bitcoin standard, everything's fixed, there's no problems anymore. That's a very childish outlook.
Yeah, but, I think Saifedean Ammous has really done so much to damage, actually, the whole concept of Bitcoin. You know, he's literally one of the people that I, you know, stopped paying attention to pretty soon after he brought his book out, yeah, and got pretty disgusted with the whole crop of people like I don't want to name names, but, you know, there's a whole crop of people that went down that path. And so I think we've already lost.
Oh, in what sense?
I think that the beginning of the ETFs, and now with the regulatory frameworks that are probably going to come under this administration, that we're already in an uncontrolled, or at least from the Bitcoin ethos, we're already at an uncontrollable asset. So, you know, the price and the narrative is driven by macroeconomics and by Wall Street and you know, other commodity interests. You know, we have such thin liquidity in the market, right? That the price swings that we've seen, look at the last 36
24 hours. Yeah, exactly.
Right, has been a real roller coaster and whatever. I think that what it can do for basic people in the States is already over, because the legislation is coming to the direction that you can already, you know, you're going to be able to pay taxes in it. And the whole point for the legalization of Bitcoin at this point is also to make it susceptible to seizure. The boat accident argument, not going to work. They're going to be like any other asset class. They're going to be, you know, give us the key to your safety deposit box if they can identify you. And if they have a reason to, they're going to seize your assets, right? So I've already moved on. I mean, I hold in Bitcoin, right? It is still for me a store of value. I don't think that the payment network is ever going to work. I think a Lightning is an absolute clusterfuck. I know people use it and people go, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, and there's the guys that do their beer taps and whatever. And at the conferences that I do, I support all of that stuff, right? I love it all. But they're really part of what it is that Satoshi originally talked about, is temporary zones of autonomy, right? And it showed what Bitcoin has done is it's shown what is possible, right? And now we have things like Monero, right? If you really want to be, if you want to have private, you know, privacy in holding your assets, right? You can do that much better on Monero than you can do with Bitcoin. We have all the chain analysis. We have all of the, you know, the rest of the AI that's coming along. You know, I think the idea that you can hide your assets in Bitcoin is really doesn't represent the truth. And this is why it is that I work with all of the layer twos, both on Bitcoin and also on Ethereum and at Monero and across other coins that are working on privacy solutions, is because I don't think that, even though Bitcoin is this like immaculate conception for a scarce good, I don't think it serves the other narratives that it is that we grew up with and that it is that we promote it. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not a Bitcoiner. It's just I think I'm a little bit more realistic about the way that is that the world works, right?
That there's like this big bifurcation in, you know, in Bitcoin and in broader like crypto, if you want to call it. There is this privacy. It's like the elephant in the room. It's like Bitcoin's privacy is lacking, and you've already detailed why that can be very problematic. Search and seizure, you know, the boating accident thing is gone, and there's a lot of people who, I mean, Monero's really right now the only standalone blockchain where people are really focusing their efforts. But when it comes to privacy with Bitcoin, do you see are you optimistic that can be improved, or is that part of why you believe things are already over?
So over is a little bit
hyperbole, but
is a little bit hyperbole. Okay. And I'm sure you guys recognize that I'm, you know,
yeah, for sure.
A colorful verbalist, let's say. Right. I think
provoking
that,
discussion.
Yeah. I appreciate your questions, really. These are good questions. So there's this whole crop of layer twos now that have taken over East Denver, right? 2 years in a row. They've just basically, you know, gone to Denver and everybody's talking about Bitcoin and not talking about Ethereum. I think there's reasons that we should talk about Ethereum. And a lot of the layer two solutions that are coming out on Bitcoin are people that have experience in Ethereum, and they're not assholes. They're not idiots. They are cypherpunks, and they're very talented engineers. And in a lot of ways, a lot of really, really good people that Bitcoiners miss out in paying attention to because they hold our values. But the great hope right now is needs two things. We need updated opcodes, and it looks like it is in the last week. Interestingly, we're seeing consensus develop around a roadmap around CTV and CFS. And a lot of the solutions that the layer twos are working on, which is zero knowledge proofs, right? Will bring privacy to Bitcoin. It's just that we don't have the unilateral exit yet. I do think it is that there's finally a realization that the inertia that has kept Bitcoin needs to change, right? And I'm really thankful for Eric Wall and Uwe Wertheimer's, absolute trolling of everybody with Taproot Wizards and with Quantum Cats. They did amazing work. They brought more people onto Bitcoin, to purchase Quantum Cats from other chains than anybody has ever been able to bring to Bitcoin, right? And started that debate really to where it is that you see people like, Jeremy Rubin and, the rest of people, all the core people are tending towards going to this direction where we're going to activate new opcodes. You have the layer twos that are on top of it, which are building around that and are offering not really tokenized situations, right, that are backed by VCs, but are looking to develop this next level of infrastructure that can open up the hope for DeFi on Bitcoin, right? And I worked for a year at Sovereign, which was a DeFi trading platform on rootstock, RSK. It's the longest serving sidechain using the EVM. But the market doesn't give a fuck about rootstock. The market doesn't give a fuck about stacks. The market doesn't give a fuck about liquid because they have all of those services on the other chains where they can move capital much faster and where it is that they can use the stable coins to get in and out of this stuff, right? So Bitcoin has a huge amount of catch up to do, but I do think that I still, hold out hope for anything that can be done elsewhere can come home to Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if we get this first, set of opcodes through the Holy Grails and OpsZK, and then those things are there. So what is the world going to do between, now and then? We really don't know. We're in this complete phase shift, right? Where nobody knows what the fuck's going on. And all of the narratives about why it is that Bitcoin is valuable are not playing out. Like inflation hedge, right? I mean, fuck. How fucked are you guys by what it costs for a burger, right? I mean, same for me, right? That one's dead, right? As well, although we have the highest inflation that you could ever expect, right? So we don't really know what's going to happen. And I think that, as soon as the ETFs were approved, it was game off for any chart, stock to flow, any of them, they all became, all bets were off the minute the ETFs were approved because the big boys came in the room and Wall Street's been doing this for fucking ever, right? So we don't really know what's going to happen other than we're going to have a favorable regulatory framework and we're going to have a free-for-all, a shitcoin casino, Trump launching meme coins the day before he's becoming president, right? Justin Sun Tron, right? Buying Trump coin and getting his SEC case dropped, of this absolutely, I call it the emoluments, coin, right? You guys know the emoluments clause of, not a president's not being able to take, presents or donations, right? So,
right.
In certain ways, I have a real mixed feeling about this administration because they're doing a lot of stuff that needs to be done. This ossification of this huge bureaucratic state that's in every piece of everybody's life that is so interlocked together is now being broken down and we don't know what's going to happen. So it's going to be a free-for-all, right? And at the core of it is Bitcoin now and the strategic Bitcoin reserve and all the work that Dennis is doing. I hosted Dennis in Frankfurt last year at Proof of Work. You know, I really respect the work that he's doing, you know, in Coin Center. And there's all these good people that are like finally getting the ear. But then there's Charles Hoskins in there. And you're like, how the fuck is Cardano part of, you know, sort of this thing? So I think we're going to have to live with a period of a permissionless free-for-all, which is probably good, but it's going to be painful for a lot of people that believe that Bitcoin is the only thing that, you know, that it should exist on the planet.
Yeah.
And I've never really felt that way, to be honest, you guys. You know, although it's enabled me to remain free and have my own sovereign life and whatever, you know, I've always sort of like questioned whether the way that, you know, the emission was done, and we have a new oligarchy, we have the whales, right? You know, the distribution of the coins is, and then the mathematics of how many UTXOs we have. And now people are talking about VTXOs, and it just gets more and more complicated and further away from just this simple, you know, aspect of be your own bank, you know,
right,
have sovereign control of your money. So the future is not written, but the future, whatever it is that we come up with, would not have happened without Bitcoin and also successfully Ethereum. You know,
I want to go back to something you said a little while, but I wanted to get in there. Like, one of the buzzwords in the Bitcoin community is like the cantillionaire effect, and talking about cantillionaires and the people who are so close to the money creation. And it's, I was joking a few weeks ago before you brought up Justin's son. I was joking a few weeks ago that being in the Discord server with, you know, Donald Trump's sons and being the first to know about a new meme coin that's about to pump, that's like the new cantillionaire. That's the new, you know, if you are loyal to the Trump administration, you have access to early, you know, pre-mined meme coins that you can get on the pump, and then you get out of them and you get with the dump, and then you get out of lawsuits or you get out of SEC investigations. But so a lot of the people who listen to the show are going to be, they groaned and cringed when you talked about Udi and Eric Wall and Ethereum. But something that I have really tried to focus on the past couple of years is not being a part, or, you know, assigning myself a team, not being a pro-Trump person or being a Republican or a Democrat or being just anti something because it's not my tribe, and trying to look at things objectively. And something that I think you made a good point, which was like these engineers, these scientists, these researchers, they're going out and they're trying to build things on these other chains, and they're ultimately going to bring that back to Bitcoin. And they're doing that. And there's these different opcodes and things that, right. Yeah. And one of the problems with the ETF and Lightning or in general, and just is the lack of block space demand, and I think just the misvalue, or like the people just don't know necessarily how to value scarce block space. So Bitcoin is scarce in the 21 million sense. But it's really also scarce in a time sense. Every 10 minutes, there's only so much block space. So you can have all the Bitcoin in the world, but if you don't manage your UTXOs and you can't actually afford access into a block in a stretch of time that is crucial. So if you, like, you're trying to get money and you need it now for, you know, for whatever reason, it's urgent and you can't get into a block.
But that's, you know, that's what the second layer solutions are for, right? That's what the Lightning Network is for.
Right. Right.
Way too complex with the liquidity problems, right? In closed channels. I mean, what is there? You know, I read last week, you know, there's something like 600 Bitcoin from a closed channel, you know, that nobody claimed, right? And like all of these certain things. I'm going to go back to one of the original things that actually I thought when I read the white paper in 2009, was that an individual Satoshi is basically just a hash that can point anywhere, right? And we need the layer twos to do that. And I think that the settlement argument for Bitcoin, you know, that you use a hash of, you know, of a lot of other transactions that we're hopefully building the solutions for, that is definitely a use case, right? It's just that all of that stuff is not happening on Bitcoin yet, right? It could happen on RSK, right? It's very efficient chain. Anything that you want to do on Ethereum, you can do on RSK. Great team, great war chest. They fucked up in the early years with their communication. And then we had the North America, South American divide, right? So the sort of like little brother American Bitcoiners didn't want to pay attention to rootstock. And we were on the back of the block size wars, and everybody was, you know, was basically traumatized from that, you know. So, but I always thought that one Satoshi would have a value for the General Motors quarterly report of 2014. The whole state of, you know, the New York Stock Exchange daily, right? You know, so I do think that people are going to be priced out of UTXOs, but the argument is that they're going to have availability on other layers of solutions, and we just don't have them yet. Yeah. So I'm not a purist in that sense. It has to happen on the base layer for it to be valid for Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. My question, it goes back to what actions or what sort of things that are going on in DeFi, when you bring it back to Bitcoin, is it, from your perspective, are the possibilities endless, or is it a more narrow scope of potential, like, you know, quote unquote smart contracts, like stuff that things like BitVM and Opcat and do these things really expand the possibilities?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you talk about like what is something that, you know, maybe you or just these, you know, other creative entrepreneurs and builders would be able to build on Bitcoin, and why the question is like, why would they bring it back to Bitcoin if it's already working on another chain?
Because Bitcoin is still the pristine collateral, is still the market leader. It still
most
has
secure
mind share. It's, you know, we memed the motherfucker into existence. Magic, internet, money, right? On the other side, I'm sitting here in 2025 and going, fuck me. I didn't think that we were going to be here until 2030, right? Yeah. And we're here also partially because of the competition that Ethereum brought to the table of composability. So Opcat, right? And the other opcos that are pretty much in consensus that are going to activate are going to allow recursive action where you can do references to things that are on chain. So you can embed a smart contract, which is autonomous and does something, right? Which is unchangeable. This is why all the stuff that's happened on Ethereum is fabulous, right? Because it's been the sandbox, right? For all of the mistakes of should contracts be upgradable or not? Should, you know what I mean? Like all of this stuff is our learnings that all of those Ethereum engineers that are building on Bitcoin are bringing over now, right? So this sort of composability, there's things happening on it. There's fabulous things happening on with like long-term loans, right? With fixed rate long-term loans, you know, where you can do a mortgage for a house permissionlessly if you have a certain amount of collateral, right? We've been doing the whole over-collateralization thing in Bitcoin, right? So you can get, you know, 25 or 30% and you're paying, you know, your price to carry, right, for that. But there's products happening on Ethereum where, you know, the basic idea of a car loan, house loan that, you know, that goes over time at a fixed rate of interest. We're now 15 years into this where people are saying, okay, this thing is going to stick around and I'm willing to take interest at, you know, X for this thing to happen. It's just that we're still stuck in this whole, you know, 10X, 50X, 100X, 1000X casino, you know, mentality, right? Which this last cycle is again, you know, sort of like a god. But all of the basic products that it is that we need, right? So recurring payments, mortgages, credits, and all of these things will eventually be there. And there'll be companies that will be doing it. But actually, what you have to watch is like this recent shakeup that's happened in Ethereum. And I'm sorry, everybody there in Bitcoin, to like mention this stuff to you, but you really, really should know about this stuff. It's really easy to shit on the, you know, on the shift and the change in leadership in Ethereum. But the changes that Vitalik has made, you know, and the way they've started now Etherealize, they're going after, you know, the banks and the companies to run finance on Ethereum. Right. And that stuff will eventually happen on Bitcoin. Right. So it's kind of like really idiotic to look at what's happening by people that are trying to solve, you know, problems where there's also this permissionless casino, right? And it's pretty cool that there's this permissionless casino. Why shouldn't people be able to lose their money? Why shouldn't people be able to be stupid and get rugged? Why should we not have pump.fun where people know that it's a how fast are you going to get rugged? The chances, you know, of getting something out have been much higher than we have in the state registered lotteries and whatever. Nobody's actually done a mathematical lottery which has, you know, on-chain, you know, proofs of where the distributions are going to go. Nobody's really done that one yet because there's far more money to be made in the way that it is that we're doing it. But let's come back
and
to
you can't and you can't tax loss Harvard. You can't write off lottery tickets on your taxes. You can write off that you lost money on a meme coin,
right? So, I mean, these are much, much larger questions. Why are people gambling in these casinos? Because there's no fucking jobs.
Yeah, right.
Because there's no fucking jobs.
And the point...
Go into that for a bit. What do you mean there's no fucking jobs? Like all the jobs are being completely washed away or what?
Automated and
we're being automated. We're being automated away, right? And, you know, people talk about... you know, MMT and socialism and, you know, like all these things. But at some point, we're going to need to have some sort of solution for being a leisure society, right? We've been borrowing against that concept moving forward, right? You know, so we have socialism for corporations, right? And we have capitalism for the worker. And it's embedded in our tax structure or whatever. So one of the great hopes for me about, you know, blockchain money or immediate money is a Tobin tax, right? Nobody's even talking about that yet. So if we're going to actually have on-chain accounting for taxation and money creation or whatever, whether it's based on Bitcoin or not, where it is that we can move is that we have, you know, a minimal transaction tax on everything. Far too much is illegal, right? Bring the goddamn fucking drugs into the economy. Everybody's using them. Why are we, you know what I mean? So we did it in Denver and everybody in Colorado and everybody went, oh, fuck, man, we have tax money, right? And so like the world is legalizing cannabis and other psychedelic drugs and whatever just because you can't stop any of this stuff, right? So what do we need to have? We need to have some form of identifiable address where it is that funds are being collected that are generated autonomously, right? And that's a Tobin tax. Get away from income tax. Get away from, you know, sales tax. Get away from all these tax structures it is that we've had in the past and move to more enlightened ones where every transaction just has a very, very small fee to pay. And that's where it is that Bitcoin fails because of the UTXO problem, right? And where it is that we need the second levels now. And so that's my hope, actually, is that Bitcoin has demonstrated a way that you can secure a global consensus for a money supply and also for accounting. Yeah, it's just the first step along the way for us getting to a more fair and more just way of doing things. Yeah,
right.
That still ignores the human question, you know. But to come back to your question, Mike, you know, about the jobs, right? We have a whole generation of people that have these incredibly powerful devices in their hands, right? That connect them to the world. And the first thing that Bitcoin established is a global consensus rule set for what has value, networked by phones. And you have crap junkies that are used to the immediacy of being able to talk, video, you know, transfer, transact all over the world, like immediately, right? And it takes time for society to catch up to that. It takes time for legislation and for, you know, for the rest of society to catch up to it. But the reason why this stuff is all going on is because people have nothing to do. People don't have a meaningful, you know, existence. It's all been rationalized away and the capital is, you know, has gone up to the top. And that's why it is that we have the populism and why it is that we have, you know, these conflicts, this polarization in society where we can't even talk to each other anymore. You know, it's like, this is the most abhorrent thing for me is just like, it's just how brutal the dialogue is. If I believe in this chain or I believe in that chain or I believe in Bitcoin Cash or I believe, you know what I mean? And just how people are like, you're a fucking asshole. You're a fucking idiot. Fuck your mother. Wah! You know, like, but that's everywhere in society at the moment, you know?
Right, right.
It's not just crypto, right?
And as much people, even the people that have technically are employed, What are they doing all day? I mean, most of them are spending it on the timeline arguing about something, politics, blockchains, or they're in group chats, or it's like even the people who are working and getting paid, they're not really working all day. They're really just, they're doing something else, like you said, on that phone, on that device, on their computer. And they're, some people have multiple jobs. Some people are making money, you know, they're on Nostr, they're getting zapped,
everybody
they're farming
good
mornings.
Space, everybody that's in meat space is also on their devices.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All day long.
Dan,
right?
You're supposed to be working right now?
Yeah, right.
Are you?
Yeah, I am. I'm podcasting instead. But
so society has changed radically is the point, right? And we need time to catch up to it. We're living through exponential times. We're living through predicted exponential times brought along by the computer processor, by silicon, right? And now we're moving into quantum computing where it's going to get even faster. Moore's law is going to continue. We're going to have to change and we're going to have to adapt. But, you know, it takes time and generations. I don't know. Like if I look at you guys, I'd say, Dan, what are you, 35, 36?
37. Yeah, you were close.
All right. Mike is probably closer to 41, 42.
God damn. Does it really show? Wow. Yeah.
Hey, man. Come on. Don't forget, I'm 62. All right. So here's the thing. So my daughter's now 32, right? And I look at her generation here in Europe, and I look at her generation in America, right? And they're not concerned with all of this identity politics shit, you know? People are globally networked and have a completely different set of values. And they look up at, you know, my generation and you know, and the generation ahead of me and are just waiting for us to fucking die and get off the planet, right? And right. And we're witnessing that being accelerated now, right? So this administration is chopping out, you know, this generational crust, right? And we have no idea what's gonna happen. So we're living in exponential times where the AI agents play this huge role, the same role that Google, you know, and Wikipedia played. There's now a generational shift in that. You know, education needs to change. There's so much that needs to shift, and it will. I'm actually really an optimist about all right. of this stuff, but we need to go through a period of burning, you know, and you know, the last, you know, Pax Americana is over, right? it's all integrated. And if you look at the markets, basically what's happened pretty much the last, let's look at the three cycles from the last 6 months. Alts have led Bitcoin have led equities, right? And equities have led the stock market. It's the fastest, most pristine capital. And we have our poly market, our prediction markets, all of these things, you know, capital is incredibly fast. And we do have some sort of networked global consensus about what should be done, right? All of the leaders are more concerned about what's happening online than they are by any control group, telephone polling, or in-person stuff. We're already in this sort of like state of building global consensus using these devices, and people do care about it. I'd like to believe that in some, you know, with rocky roads and whatever, that humanity will present, will, you know, move forward.
Persist.
And that the generations that come behind me have learned from my mistakes. And I see that in a positive sense. And I see the way that Bitcoin and the rest of the, you know, the field that's come along have contributed to that. We have a new global concept of borderless money. It's amazing, man. You know,
yeah.
And they're going to try and, you know, the gatekeepers are going to be there, you know, value extraction, value added, whatever, you know, we're not going to get away from that. But at least it's visible to everybody, right? It's actually visible to how things work. And so you have a whole generation of younger people that are growing up with this landscape that can see it in a way that it is that we couldn't see it, you know, when we were their age, right? So,
right. Yeah. And with this total breakdown of, like you said, Pax Americana, all the post-World War II institutional order that's the bedrock of like Western civilization and modern society has been built upon for the last few generations, that's all crumbling apart. It's going to break down into much more ephemeral deals. The countries, trading groups, they're going to have deals that work for each other, alliances, peace war, conflicts, whatever, and it's all going to be done on an individual basis. And the value of U.S. dollar denominated equities, a longer time horizon investment, things like that, they're going to lose value outside of that U.S. jurisdiction, that, you know, law system where the equities are, you're not going to have as much value as a Chinese investor in long-term equities. Right. And AI is going to accelerate the amount of transaction speed over borders. It's all rapidly changing. And Bitcoin really is
already there. And this is what that looks like. That's what, this is what that competitor, this is what the cypherpunk set into motion has led to, is this volatility.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That is washing out the insanity of the way it is that we've done debt-based economics and borrowing against our future endlessly, you know?
Exactly.
So on that side, I'm pretty pro Bitcoin about, you know, a deflationary and, you know, scarce asset and in driving this change in society. Yeah, definitely. It's obvious that we've accomplished.
Real last question of the interview here, but the U.S. news, the Strategic Reserve, yada, 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 Donald Trump, has been dominating the headlines for the past few months. But what's going on with the Bitcoin community, the trends, that what's going on in Europe right now, and what is coming up, Bitcoin, a big Bitcoin holiday, Bitcoin Pizza Day coming up in May. What's going on in Europe for all that? And there's some really good conferences coming up in Europe as well.
So for the last 4 years at Parallelnipolis in Prague, which is where all of us were meeting in the early days, you know, where Adam Back came and Peter Todd and Eric Lombroso and Andreas Antonopoulos, when there was 600 or 800 of us, you know, I mean, we started out in Prague, right? And so Parallelnipolis was the house that hosted Hackers Congress Parallelnipolis. And what grew out of that is people that were involved in the house, you know, are Trezor, right? Satoshi Labs, Slush Pool, which is now called Brains. They were all projects that grew out of, the cypherpunk and crypto anarchist movement here in Europe that happened in the Czech Republic. So for the last 4 years, we've been doing Bitcoin Pizza Day. Last year was the Scaling Wars. We had all the L2s there. We had Build on Bob, we had Citrea, and, you know, all the different people like Christian Liu, who's now joined Alpen Labs, which is in the States. You know, a lot of people are going to Alpen. All the top people that I know, all the smart young kids are all working at Alpen. John Light, that I worked with together at Sovereign and everything. So this year, the theme is Make Crisis Great Again. So pizzaday.cz is the URL. There's, like six speakers up at the point. So if there's anybody who feels like they have something to add, we have a call for proposals and that we review when we bring people in. We're constantly bringing in new blood. So that's happening in May. I'll also be emceeing the Monero con in Prague in June. And then we have BTC Prague coming up, you know, then there's Lugano, you know, there's tons of things happening in Europe. And I highly recommend for anybody that's along the lines of BTC Plus, you know, from Nifty Nay, any of the people that are going to Austin or on that sort of track that are interested in the people that are building, man, come to the conferences in Europe. Yeah, they're a completely different thing than BTC Miami, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
They're really... What happens around Bitcoin and crypto in general in Europe, the conferences are really, you know, high signal, low noise. And because they're smaller, you get to meet and talk to everybody, right? That's the thing that most people don't realize, is that all of these people that they see on Twitter who all have their invested opinions and invested projects and invested personalities and communities that they serve by talking about Bitcoin the way that they do, when those people are in Europe, they're totally approachable, right? You can come and you can hang out and like talk to people, and they're incredibly humble, you know, and helpful people that, you know, have a lot of experience in what Bitcoin is about. And I think that, you know, this has like always been one of the things that's bothered me, is that everybody thinks that the small group of people that they identify with in Bitcoin is the Bitcoin community. And the fact of the matter is there's a zillion Bitcoin communities. So I'm sure you guys scoped, like, we've never met before, right? We just sort of like showed up on each other's radar. And before this, you know, I spent the last couple of days scanning your guys' timelines, like seeing who it is that you're connected with and who the people are, you know, opinion leaders in the space and whatever in your market.
The social graph, yeah.
Your social graph. And I was like, who the fuck are these people, right? And,
totally.
And a lot of people are probably like, who the fuck is this Michael Perini guy? You know what I mean? And there's 30 or 40 communities like this that are large and have their social graph, that have their media and their podcasts. You know, we have Block Space Media now with Charlie Spears that have come up, you know, right? And we have older podcasts like, you know, yeah. Anyway,
yeah,
the point is there's a lot of Bitcoin communities out there. And if you truly care about Bitcoin, freedom, decentralization, like all of these things, get out of your bubble, man. And if you're not going to get out of your bubble and look at some of the other credible coins and their communities and their engineers, at least get involved with the different communities that are in Bitcoin and widen your horizons. Because, you know, just having like a narrow narrative, everybody gets the Bitcoin that they deserve, you know, not the at price, but everybody gets the Bitcoin that they're capable of expanding their mind to. And we're, you know, so many different subcultures in America, political, social, ethnic, you know, musical, whatever, you know, and the world is such a large place and everybody comes at it from a different point of view and has their own path along the way, you know, to making it work for them, man. Get out of your bubble is what I'd say, you know, check things out, right?
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much. We definitely want to get you on here again in the future and narrow the scope of what we talk about, because obviously there is, you could talk about a lot of interesting things that we'd love to dig up further. But I think the summary of what I would say is you don't have to go out and diversify your portfolio and buy a bunch of what you think are shit coins or whatever. But absolutely, it is important to follow the developments, follow the technical engineering, because there's so much going on out there. And some of it's already coming back to Bitcoin. Some of it's going to come back to Bitcoin. And you, by the time you are thinking about, oh, am I going to upgrade my node for this soft fork or this new consensus? It's like you're way behind. You've got to figure out what's going on and what is changing in the world and on in this technology, and understand the implications of it and how it can benefit you or how you may think it's a threat to the consensus and the protocol. But you've got to follow this stuff. Just shrugging it off as a scam or a shitcoin is, it's fine if you're talking about what you want to invest in right now, but you've got to learn the technology and appreciate some of it there's a lot of possibilities.
It's not only a technological question, it's a social question. Bitcoin is for everybody, man.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, if you want to have your right to use Bitcoin the way it is that you want to use it, you have to accept that other people have a way that they want to use it. And to have and demanding that people use it in a certain way is nothing different than a fiat.
Right. And it's also important, like a lot of people, when it comes to this, I save Bitcoin, but they don't really use it, especially peer-to-peer on chain very often, if ever. And you get everybody can use Bitcoin. If you get a bunch of people who come to the space and they are really using and building on Bitcoin, Bitcoin is going to go in a direction that you just don't even understand, and you're going to be left behind. You don't want to be right now. Things are accelerating everywhere, politically, economically, on chain. Everything's accelerating. It's going very fast. And if you don't keep up with it, you're going to be left behind. And it has to start with exposing yourself to other ideas, exposing yourself to other communities. Yeah. 100%.
I went through all of these purist arguments, okay? So anybody out there is like, well, this guy is kind of like, you know, whack off, you know, whatever. I went through all of the narratives and all the purist phases and watched them change and fall and not become dominant and not become relevant, right? And I never wanted to know as much about economics and money issuance and computer code. And like, I never wanted to know.
He just wanted to go on a,
after 15 years, right? It was not
just wanted to go on a Deadhead tour. And now, you have to have a PhD in economics.
That's right.
Right. Hell so, yeah. I mean, I'm constantly, I go through periods of like, fuck, I can't keep up, man. I can't do this anymore. Right. But then I do, it's a long, long, long marathon, man. It's not just a sprint.
If people want to call you a whack off, where do they find you?
You find me as Exiled Surfer everywhere, on X is where it is that I pretty much live. And also on Noster. Yeah, but I'm not on TikTok. If you're interested in what it is that I've had to say about Bitcoin on various podcasts over the years, on YouTube, Exiled Surfer playlist is a playlist of the different conversations I've had and, the conferences that I've moderated and the people that I'm associated with. You can, those are the good places. Twitter and YouTube is the best way to dive into what it is that I think about this stuff.
Excellent. Cool. Thank you so much for coming on today. Definitely.
Yeah, man. I saw you guys post you were coming back. I remember the podcast, right?
Thank you.
I saw a few episodes here and there amongst things. I spend more time doing things than actually, watching material, but I saw the announcement. I was like, oh yeah, cool, man. You guys are back. Let's do one. So happy to come back. And next time, do prepared questions and you won't have to do the 20 minutes of who I am at the beginning. Happy to come back.
Happy to.
100%.
Happy to support you guys. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And only one request, Dan. Give Mike a chance. Give Mike a little bit more chance to ask questions.
Oh.
Yep.
I'll cut it right there.
The fans are going to love that one.
Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked 80 IQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!